We're talking about Wisconsin's tornado season on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have seen devastating storms rip across the central U.S. In the past week alone, authorities linked tornadoes to at least 7 deaths, many injuries. Government weather forecasters logged preliminary reports of more than 500 tornadoes in a 30-day period. That is rare, uncharted territory, as one meteorologist put it to the New York Times this week. On average, here in Wisconsin, we get 23 tornadoes a year. Have you ever been in one? When did it happen, and where were you? How did you stay safe? Does your family have tornado preparedness plans? Join in 800-642-1234. Tim Halbach is a warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service based out of the Milwaukee Sullivan office. Tim, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thanks for having me this morning.
Well, it seems the central U.S. is really stuck in a cycle of dangerous storms that just aren't stopping. And just this week, we saw tornadoes struck Iowa, Illinois, Ohio, Kansas, other states. What is causing this?
Well, we've been in a stuck pattern where if you talk to anybody down in the far southeastern United States, it's been a heat wave down there. And kind of that contrast area between where we have the warm, juicy air mass and where it's cold, like what we've been in, that's basically the belt for where we look for this kind of activity. So for us, it's been just to our south. It's kind of wavered back and forth, you know, for where we'd be looking for where these storms would occur. We've been in the same pattern where the winds that are not just at the ground but above the ground have been very strong. It's helped to create the perfect setup for a lot of the severe weather.
So you're seeing like the warm, juicy air masses from the Gulf colliding with the colder air from the north?
Correct. Yeah. And one of the areas that we always look for is where the warm front or a stationary front would be, that kind of marks what the difference in those two air masses is. So when we have a day where that's parked over our area or part of Wisconsin, and we have storms that develop along it, that can be a focus for where you can see severe weather, thunderstorms. There's a lot of different ingredients that we look at to try to forecast whether or not we're going to have those kinds of storms. But thankfully for Wisconsin, we've missed out on it, but it doesn't mean that, you know, we're out of the park here.
And we'll get to Wisconsin in a moment, but what we're seeing right now in the central U.S., is this unusual at all for this time of year?
Well, it's this time of year when we start seeing an uptick in activity. It had actually been a fairly quiet, severe weather season up until about a week and a half ago. But it just kind of shows you how fast things can change from being a quiet year to just a ridiculously busy lot of severe weather, when you get into the right setup there. So for, I think, the last 10 days, there's been some sort of elevated or higher risk of severe weather somewhere in the United States. And thankfully, at least looks like it's going to be ending for in the next day or so here.
So is it true that the upper Midwest has fewer intense tornadoes than the rest of the Midwest? Are we buffered at all because of our location?
The frequency isn't as great. If you go a little bit further to the south and west, you get into what's, called Tornado Alley. But they see quite a few tornadoes. The thing is, down there, they don't have as much of population for where a tornado could go through. So a lot of them end up being in farm fields and things like that. The southeastern United States has tornadoes all year round, and that's can be more particularly dangerous because people got to be prepared all year for these large tornadoes. For us up here in Wisconsin, we have maybe a shorter season, which means our frequency might be a little bit less, but we can get tornadoes and severe weather any time of year if the ingredients come together.
We're talking about severe weather and the dangers of tornadoes. Those ingredients with Tim Halbach. He's a warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service based out of the Milwaukee Sullivan office. Does your family have a tornado preparedness plan? What does it look like? How often do you practice it? Do you have supplies at home or in your car so that you feel prepared? We're at 800-642-1234. You can join in. Tim, how does a meteorologist like like yourself, determine that a tornado is coming? How do you track it?
So the way that we can get any kind of lead time on it is to use our radar. We can pick up on rotation and sometimes debris getting lofted up into the air from our radar. Our goal is to get people lead time so that they know that the tornado is there first. But then once the tornado is on the ground, we rely on spotters to be able to report to us what is actually happening so that we can confirm that, hey, that tornado is there. You really need to be into the basement when the storm's coming in. So like yesterday over in the Kansas with one of the storms that went through there, they could pick up on debris on the radar going up about 25,000 feet. Mm. When we start seeing things like that, that tells us that this is going to be a very strong to violent tornado that's occurring.
And when do you decide to put out a tornado warning? And what's the difference between a watch and a tornado warning?
So first, with a watch, when the Storm Prediction Center issues those, they're part of the Weather Service, and we work with them to get those watches out. That's kind of your first kind of, you know, heads up. The ingredients are coming together here for potential for severe weather. So you need to be ready that if you know, a storm develops later on that goes to a warning, you're prepared for it. So the watch is kind of your heads up. And then the warning means that storm is there. You need to take action. So how we pick up on that, again, is the radar. If we're doing an analysis of where the environment's more favorable for tornadoes and we see a storm going up along it and there's some sort of velocity or we're seeing some rotation on our radar that is strengthening, that'll lead us to issue that first tornado warning to give people a heads up. It can be pretty quick that these tornadoes last, so our goal is to try to get that warning out before the tornado occurs.
What are some key safety tips you can give people?
So make sure you have ways to receive warnings. I'm sure if you've watched the news after tornado, there's people that'll say, you know, there was no warning. A lot of times there was a warning. It's just that people don't have a way to receive that warning. So have an app on your phone that you know will get you a warning. Severe thunderstorm warnings do not come through on the wireless emergency alerts. No weather radios are a great tool to have on as well. If there's a day that you're expecting severe thunderstorms or sometimes when you're not, just to have that on. And also, you know, we tell people to turn on the TV, watch your television meteorologists. They're going to give you play-by-play for where the storms are going to be. And, you know, that's something that is extremely valuable for people to confirm the risk for whether or not that tornado is going to be close to them.
In the last 30 seconds or so, where should you take shelter in your home?
So anywhere below grade. So in Wisconsin, there's a lot of places that have basements. That's a fantastic place to go. There's no favorite part of the basement to go into. Just being below grade is the spot that you want to be at. An extra step would be to get underneath a table so that if stuff falls into the house, that falls onto that extra level of, you know, a force. If you don't have a basement, the interior part of your house, try to put as many walls between you and the outside as possible, and stay away from windows. And those are some of the main things, particularly if you're at home.
Tim, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Tim Halbach is a warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service at the Milwaukee Sullivan office. Up next, we're talking about this year's tick and mosquito season and what researchers are learning from a new smartphone app. What questions do you have about these blood suckers? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. The tick population is booming. We're getting a read on what this season will be like here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin had more than 3,000 estimated cases of Lyme disease last year. That's a sharp increase from a decade ago, according to state health authorities. What questions do you have about ticks or mosquitoes? Have you noticed more in your neighborhood or in your favorite park? What have you done to protect yourself? And did you get Lyme disease from a tick? We're at 800-642-1234. Lyric Bartholomew is a UW-Madison professor who studies infectious disease agents in mosquitoes, ticks, and other parasites. Lyric, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much.
So we've heard from farmers this year about their fields being too wet to plant crops. Has the amount of rain been a good thing for mosquitoes since they like standing water for breeding?
They do. I think the challenge is just like for us. Those mosquitoes are still waiting for it to get warm. And so so they could be out in those standing water in those fields, but it's just been too cold for them to develop very quickly. So we're anticipating that as the weather warms up now, we'll see a lot more activity.
The past winter felt really brutal with the polar vortex. Did Wisconsin's winter change the outlook at all for mosquito or tick populations?
Yeah, great question. I don't really think so. Those insects and ticks are really well adapted to the cold.
What? Are you kidding me?
Isn't it amazing? They even have fat reserves, just like we do, to make it through the winter.
How dare they?
Yeah.
You know, mosquitoes and ticks carry different diseases. The Zika virus in mosquitoes, Lyme disease in ticks are two that really get a lot of attention. Which pest is the bigger health concern right now?
Oh, great question. The ticks are absolutely the public enemy number one, public health enemy number one at the moment. They really transmit a lot of pathogens to a lot of people. Of course, we still are concerned about mosquitoes and mosquito-borne diseases, but in terms of total numbers, it's really ticks that are the big concern.
And help us understand what they transmit, how they do it, and what Lyme disease is.
Yeah, so ticks have this complex life cycle that involves feeding on different kinds of hosts. And so they start out and they feed on a rodent, on a mouse usually, and get infected with the pathogen at that first life stage. And then they're infected for life. So the next couple of life stages are those that we may encounter. Those are called the nymphs and the adults. And so the problem is that if we encounter a nymph that has already been infected with the Lyme disease bacteria when it was a larva, it can pass it on to us. And in Wisconsin, we have a number of those ticks that are indeed infected. So if we look at infection rates, you know, the total number of ticks in the environment that might be infected with the Lyme disease bacteria can be 20-30%. So a lot of the ticks you might encounter could be infected with the bacteria. And then if they feed on you and they stay attached to you for at least 36 hours, they can pass it on just with their saliva as they're stuck to you and blood feeding.
Well, let's take a call now. Let's go to Martha joining us from Edgerton. Hi, Martha.
Good morning. I contracted Lyme disease about 14 years ago in Edgerton, Wisconsin. I was working in my garden here and had a classic case of the bullseye rash on my leg, which I was only able to identify because I had grown up in Lyme, Connecticut.
Oh, really? Wow.
And, yeah. So we were very aware of Lyme disease there. And I went to the doctor right away, who was at that time not familiar with the bullseye rash, and looked it up and did some research while I was in the doctor's office. And, of course, I was treated appropriately with a course of antibiotics and never had any further repercussions from the disease, luckily. So my comment is that I hope today that doctors, local doctors and doctors in Wisconsin, are familiar with some of the
symptoms,
of
right?
Yes.
Martha, thank you so much for the call and recognizing that in terms of the symptoms. You know, what should you be looking for?
Yeah, well, Martha's case is a spot on for the kinds of things you'd want to be looking for, and it's great that she was so aware of what to look for. We see that in about 70 to 80% of the people who contract the Lyme bacteria, that they do have that bullseye rash. So that's one of the hallmark first signs of having contracted that bacteria. Beyond that, it looks a lot like a bacterial infection. So, you know, there's headaches and fevers. And one of the first reasons that we recognized that Lyme was an issue was that it also causes some joint pain, some arthritis.
We're talking with Professor Lyric Bartholomew, and she works in the Department of Pathobiological Sciences at UW-Madison. Lyric, you helped launch a smartphone app last year to collect reports of tick sightings. What were you hoping to learn from that app?
Yeah, thanks. So we launched the Tick app as a joint project with some really great collaborators here on campus with the Center for Health Enhancement Services and Engineering and with colleagues in the Northeast at Columbia University in New York. And what we're hoping to understand is really when is it that people encounter ticks? So like Martha explained to us that she encountered her tick probably when she was out gardening. We'd like to understand if it's when people are gardening, if it's when they are out recreating, if they're perhaps out for hikes with their pets, those kinds of things, so that we can really understand when that interface happens. When do you come in contact with the tick and thereby be able to tell people, here are the places where you really need to be able to protect yourself. I think in the process of doing the tick app work and also understanding where ticks are in Wisconsin, we're starting to see that Wisconsinites are really outdoorsy people. So that's one of the things that came through loud and clear from the data we collected from the tick app. And that some people are indeed encountering ticks more often in their own backyards. So the paradigm used to sort of be that if you were out camping or hiking or fishing, that might be when you're most likely to encounter ticks up north in Wisconsin. But they're increasingly encroaching into our backyards and more across the state.
Let's go to Tom in Madison now. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. I just wanted to make the comment that if you take steps to protect yourself, you can really eliminate virtually eliminate the risk of Lyme disease from ticks and so forth. And there's a Department of Defense standard, which I adhere to. I'm a forager. I spend a lot of time in the woods. And as you know, the morel season is just concluding, and I spent hours and hours, even crawling on hands and knees under brush.
The question is, Tom, have you found any
ticks?
No, we're on
the
yeah.
It wasn't my best season. I did end up with about 3 or 4 pounds, but it was okay. There is a chemical called permethrin, which is recommended for clothing and gear, not to be applied to skin, and that actually kills ticks as soon as they come on contact. And I've seen them drop onto my clothing and crawl a few, maybe an inch or so, and then just fall right off.
Mm. Tom, we're a little bit short on time. I just want to get back to Lyric on that. What about the chemicals that deter them?
Tom is a great spokesperson. Thanks, Tom, for that. And I've always wanted to do a study on the correlation between morels and ticks, and I've done some of that work myself. I think the first thing that Tom mentioned was the permethrins, and these are really great. So you can buy these at the store and coat your own clothing, or you can purchase clothing that's already impregnated with those. And like he said, those actually kill ticks. So if you spend a lot of time outdoors in high-risk places where you know there are ticks, that's a really smart first line of defense. You can also use the spray-on repellents. So repellents with things like DEET and picaridin in them are really effective and helpful. And the EPA has a great site to explain to you which products have which sort of doses of those things. And so you can make learned choices for yourself. And also there's some simple things you can do, like wearing light-colored clothing. The ticks that transmit Lyme are sort of very small but dark black. And so if you're wearing light-colored clothing, that makes it a lot easier to detect them. We recommend that you wear long pants and long sleeves, light colors, and even tuck your pants into your socks when you're outdoors so that ticks don't have that entry at the point of your ankles to crawl up your leg.
Is it the same drill for mosquitoes?
Yeah, light-colored clothing and long sleeves help with mosquitoes, too. And those impregnated clothes are really helpful. And absolutely, repellents are great.
You know, in our last 30 seconds here, how difficult is it to study ticks?
Yeah, ticks are a good challenge. We do a lot of work on ticks across the state as part of our Midwest Center of Excellence for Vector-Borne Disease, and the UW Medical Entomology Lab has long done really great work on ticks. Our study tool of choice is actually a white cloth, and we have these white cloths that are canvas, and they have actually sort of long digits, weighted digits on them, so that when you are out looking for ticks, you can actually just drag this white cloth behind you and attract and collect ticks that way. Mm-hmm. And so that really simple tool has opened up tick research across the nation, really. It's been really helpful.
Lyric, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you so much.
Lyric Bartholomew is a UW-Madison professor who studies infectious disease agents in mosquitoes, ticks, and other parasites. Coming up, online consumer contracts are long. They're hard to understand. We look into those terms of service and what it means when you click I agree. That is after this news update here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about terms of service contracts here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. When you go online to buy something or use apps, you've encountered these long, complex service agreements. These user agreements can govern things like how a company uses your data. Click agree, and you may forfeit your right to sue, for instance. And then this influential group of legal experts postponed a vote last week on a proposal that critics say would bind consumers to contracts they don't agree with or just plain old don't understand. Do you ever read the terms and conditions on apps and websites, or do you just click past them so you can get on with what you need to do? And if you have read them, did you understand them? We're at 800-642-1234. You can join in. Ian McDougall is a contributing reporter at ProPublica, and his piece about online consumer contracts is called "Soon You May Not Even Have to Click on a Website Contract to Be Bound by Its Terms." Ian, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what are these terms of service contracts, and where do we encounter them most often?
They're really everywhere online. Essentially, what they are is sort of standardized terms that by clicking agree, for example, if you, download software or are making purchases online, you are binding yourself to this often very, very long and very sort of complex set of terms written in sort of legalese by lawyers. And at times, some courts have found, and the group you're just talking about would probably make this more common, simply browsing a website and not leaving it can be enough to bind you to those terms.
And is each contract unique, or do they share a lot of the same stuff from one website to the next? Is there a typical contract?
They are likely unique, but they do have many. There's a lot of overlap. So, for example, you would likely see waivers of, for example, if you're buying something, waivers of class action litigation, meaning even if, it's not worth it for me to go to court because the thing I bought wasn't worth it. You know, there are many consumers, we can kind of essentially all bind together, and so some of the cost is shared that way. Often there are mandatory arbitration clauses, which means you can't even go to court. You have to go to this sort of private, fairly opaque process that's viewed as very pro-business. You may give up the right to sue near where you live. You might have to travel to New York or to wherever the manufacturer is based. Those are fairly common terms that are in these kinds of agreements.
And these agreements also have information on what the company might do with your data?
That's right. Yeah, there's really run the gamut from just sort of collecting essentially what you're doing on the website to collecting where you're coming from to you may agree to allow them to surveil your conduct in other ways, And probably most troubling to a lot of people is there's often provisions that allow for the data that is collected by a website to be essentially bundled and sold to data brokers.
You these online contracts ask consumers to do things that you never have to agree to in real life. And you give an example of, buying jeans at a Walmart store. Can you take us through this?
Sure. So, I mean, any, big box retailer, essentially, if you go to the store, I suppose, at least those of us of a certain age, I don't know, maybe the younger generation is just online these days, but, you go and you bring the, whatever jeans, whatever it is to the cashier, you may sign some sort of receipt if you use your credit card, but you basically know what the terms are. You are giving a certain amount of money for a product, and then maybe some limited other set of terms, but it's there right in front of you, and it's not that voluminous. If you try to engage in that same transaction online on that retailer's website, you are dealing with a set of terms that are many, many, many times longer than what you would see on a receipt at a store. You may be giving up things like there's something called the warranty of merchantability, which basically means that the product you're being sold would pass without objection in the trade, and you often give that up when you buy something online, whereas you wouldn't in person. And then there's also the kinds of things we were just talking about, class action waivers, arbitration requirements. You may indemnify the retailer for cost if you have a dispute with them. And then, of course, there's the data and privacy issues, which, of course, wouldn't come up in an in-person transaction.
So the warranty of merchantability, I've never heard of that before.
It's one of many sort of essentially background rules that whether it's in a contract or not govern the sale of goods in most and maybe all states. But those kinds of warranties, of which there are several, are the kinds of things that are often you're essentially agreeing to waive in these online agreements.
And we've all done it. We've clicked on the I agree button for these terms of service contracts. Reading them is a whole nother story. How did these contracts become so difficult for a person to understand so long?
Yes, I mean, they have these kinds of contracts. The general idea, they're called often contracts of adhesion, meaning the seller just gives it to you and you can take it or leave it. They have a long history, and the sort of current state of things goes back to, I guess there's a legal reason, a business reason for the reason they are, as long as they are, and it's complicated. The legal reason is in the 90s, there was federal judge in Chicago named Frank Easterbrook, who's viewed as a very smart but very pro-business guy, and he ruled in this case essentially that in buying software with shrink wrap that has the sort of terms inside the shrink wrap, once you open it and use the product, even if there's no evidence you actually read the terms, you've agreed to them, that then you can kind of see the leap to going online from there. And so then from a business perspective, there was good reason to want to pack as much as you can into these contracts if they're going to be enforceable. The people who are in favor of this sort of thing say, well, it's just, it's more efficient for them. They don't have to negotiate each of these aspects. The critics say, well, when you sold these things in person, you didn't have these things at all, so it's not clear why you really need all this. But for businesses, it's kind of, there's no page limit, there's no word limit. Why not put in everything you want? And then if a court says, no, this term isn't enforceable, well, so be it. But it also, people are less likely to look at terms or see terms that they don't like if they're sort of buried in a very long a document full of legal jargon.
We're talking about terms of service contracts with Ian McDougall as our guide. He's a contributing reporter for ProPublica. You can join in 800-642-1234. If you've never read online terms and conditions, why don't you read them? Does it bother you that online contracts are written in legalese? Does not knowing what you're agreeing to concern you at all? Or are you unfazed? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Ian, what about allowing companies to sell our data? What does that mean? And where can our data end up when you click I agree on a contract?
Well, you know, it's a sort of ever-evolving thing. I think there's, you know, with the concerns about Facebook and so on, we may see, are seeing, and probably will see more and more restrictions, sort of pro-privacy restrictions. But, you know, there are, you know, companies that essentially buy large volumes of data from all kinds of retailers and other websites, aggregate all of that, and then sell it to, basically whoever can pay for it. So that's, you know, that means it can end up in the hands of, sort of the most basic thing, I guess, is people trying to sell you something. But certainly there are, you know, potentially more troubling, even more troubling purchasers out there, I suppose.
So even if a company doesn't have an arbitration agreement in their contract, what are some other restrictions that might be included to limit a consumer's ability to sue?
Yeah, so the there's the class action waivers. You know, one of the big problems with this stuff is you know, even let's say a car, which is probably in the upper end of you know, cost for a consumer good. It's often not worth it to hire a lawyer to litigate that because it's probably going to cost you more than the value of the car. And the likely payout for an individual plaintiff is going to be so low that a lawyer is not going to take it on contingency, which means they'll just take it. They won't, you don't have to pay them up front, but they'll take a part of the award. So class actions were a way to kind of have a bunch of plaintiffs come together and make it more likely that a lawyer would take it on like that. It's quite common now to have that kind of thing waived in these contracts. There's also things like, you know, mentioned where you can sue. So even if you're allowed to go to court, you might have to travel halfway across the country or hire a lawyer halfway across the country if you want to sue. There are sort of protections for non-copyright material. This probably doesn't come up quite as much, but, you know, in terms of how you can use the product can be limited in ways that many consumers may not know. And there are sort of other ways that financial liability is often required to be waived in these agreements.
How have courts responded to people fighting against online terms and conditions?
It depends on who you ask. There certainly have been many cases like that, especially harkening back to that case I mentioned earlier from the shrink wrap era. The courts have said, you know, it's unrealistic that people aren't going to read these things. We have backstops, you know, if a term is unconscionable or something like that, we can deal with that on the back end. Other courts have said, well, you know, we need to be more wary of instances where really important terms, where you're waiving really important rights, for example, are buried in hundreds of pages of legalese, like those, you know, end user agreements you get from Apple when you buy anything there, for example.
We're talking about service agreements on websites and what they mean for people who shop online or even browse the internet. Ian McDougall is a contributing reporter at ProPublica. He's been writing about these contracts. Lawyers out there, what's your take on all of this? Do you think online terms and services should be more user-friendly? Or is this the way companies need to operate in order to protect themselves? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email your thoughts on terms of service. The email is ideas@WPR.org. We'll get back to this discussion in just a minute. Stay with us here in the Ideas Network. We're looking at the world of terms of service, these contracts that we encounter all over the place online. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Last week, the American Law Institute was about to approve a sweeping reinterpretation of consumer contract law, and the group postponed their vote indefinitely. And so now we're talking about what it means to abide by the terms of use for a site. How do you solve that problem that barely anyone reads the terms and conditions of a contract, even after clicking to agree that you've read it. We're at 800-642-1234. Ian McDougall is a contributing reporter to ProPublica, and he stays with us. Let's go to the phones now with Barb joining us from Milwaukee. Good morning, Barb.
Good morning. When my son was in college, both my sons were in college, they decided to design a website called Yes, I Disagree. And it was all about the terms and services. One of my sons was an English major. And so he was reading all the terms and services on every single website he could find. And then he outlines on his website what the different little key points are for each place. My other son, excuse me, was in IT, so he designed the site. It was, you know, a given. Anyway, these there are things on there that are really tricky. Like there are some sites where if you click Yes, I Disagree, they have access to all of your photos, and they can use them for their own purposes. So, excuse me, before you want to give all your kids' information away, you really should read this and not sign it. And I think it's important that people actually go through and figure out, are these things that they want to give away all of their contacts on, you know, on their phone or all their kids' pictures or et cetera, et cetera.
Barb, thank you so much for the call. And Ian, are there resources out there that people can go to better know what they are getting into?
Well, that website she just described, I wasn't aware of it, but that sounds like a great resource. You know, I won't pretend to be an expert in sort of the resources for checking on these things, but there certainly are websites like that out there. You know, I will say one thing that, a lot of the debate has been about whether these kinds of agreements should be allowed or not, or how they should be governed when you get to court. A sort of middle ground that I think there are people in both the business community, although probably fewer of them, and in the consumer advocacy community think is not a terrible solution is to have essentially a requirement that, and this sort of already exists, but that really important terms like the ones that the caller was just describing need to be, you know, really foregrounded and highlighted in a way that people will be able to see and make a conscious decision, yes, I agree, or yes, I want to keep browsing this website, or no, I don't. I don't want to give up all of that information. I don't want to give up whatever rights.
I wonder, are there any, like, secondary things that can happen once you do click agree that can say, like, hey, do you realize that, you know, we can mine your photos, we can mine your contacts that you have in your phone right now, that there could be, you know, even some secondary screens that to make sure you really do agree to this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of one of the sort of middle ground solutions that I think some people have brought up. The argument from the business side is, oh, it's inefficient, it's annoying to consumers. That may be true, but the other side would say, well, yeah, but, you know, consumers are going to want to know before they're agreeing to give away all this private information or agreeing to give up certain rights. You're going to want to know that they're doing that, and they may very well still agree to go ahead and make that use that website, but at least, you know, then they're making a conscious decision to engage in that transaction rather than being sort of blindsided by it.
Well, help us understand who the American Law Institute is and what this organization has to do with online contracts.
Yeah, it's about a century old. It's not really widely known outside of legal communities, but very, very well known to lawyers. It's essentially was founded to try to clarify and sort of concentrate in one place, almost like an almanac, something called the common law, which essentially is, you know, we have statutes that make law, but the U.S. comes from a British tradition of judge-made law, and that governs things from contracts to, you know, who's responsible when someone gets hurt in an accident to, you know, property rights. That's become more and more based on statute over time. But what the ALI did essentially was create these, what they call the restatements of law, which tried to draw from judicial opinions across the country. You know, each state has their own judicial system and can make their own common law rules, and try to kind of figure out, well, what seems to be the majority rule? You know, is there a minority rule? You know, so 20 states do this, 30 states do that, and where do things seem to be heading? And so that was kind of their they are core innovation, and those restatements have traditionally been used. And so there's one for contracts generally that's been around for a really long time and is highly respected. Those are viewed as something close to an authoritative statement, or historically have been, of the common law by judges. So you see those cited in judicial opinions, you know, across the country. And sometimes states will even adopt them as essentially their own law or parts of them.
So what was the ALI, what was this group trying to do for online terms of service? What did it want to, what was it voting on?
So it was a new restatement, which would be focused on essentially a subset of contracts, these consumer contracts we're talking about, and the bulk of it deals with, you know, the online e-commerce kind of world. The objection to it from many members was essentially, well, we already have this general contract one. Why are we making this sort of slicing off this one piece of it? Essentially, the disagreement was about whether they should do this at all, or whether it's, you know, fine to just have it be part of the general contracts restatement.
So if this does come to pass, what would it look like from the consumer's perspective? What would this mean going forward on websites and consent?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how quickly websites and so on would respond to it, potentially quite quickly. But, you know, really what would happen is, you know, if this became a respected restatement, you would see it get cited in judicial opinions. It would influence the law in that way. And it might also influence, you know, state legislatures when they're passing statutes that deal with this kind of stuff. So in that sense, its effect on the law might, you know, take a little bit of time. But, you know, I think if businesses see it heading in that direction, they may be all the more inclined to push along the lines that they've been moving until recently.
So, Ian McDougall, in your reporting on all of this, going deep into terms of service, is anyone out there coming up with an alternative, another way of doing these contracts so they are more understandable, but they still protect companies?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of some of the stuff we were talking about earlier, the sort of highlighting in some fashion, whether it's some additional screen or providing the, you know, really important or really significant terms in some sort of bolded, obvious way. I think that's one of the sort of big ways that you know, consumer advocates and so on would like to move this process.
And I understand that Elizabeth Warren had a role in trying to get the ALI to stop this vote. How political are terms of service and, you know, what contracts are like for consumers online?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's consumer protection has become a quite significant political flashpoint. I mean, Elizabeth Warren helped set up the CFPB, the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. I'm pretty sure I got that acronym mm-hmm. right. And there's been a lot of pushback against it. There was a great New York Times Magazine piece recently by Nick Confessori about Mick Mulvaney, the chief of staff for the president, you know, really trying to dismantle a lot of the work agency has done. So it's a highly politicized statement. You know, any time there are business interests who are putting money into lobbying and so on, interest groups representing consumers doing the same, you know, of course, there's going to be a political fight about it.
Well, Ian, before we let you go here, just a few seconds, but how do you approach terms of service contracts when you're online? What do you do?
I mean, to be honest, I'm a lawyer too, so I shouldn't admit this, but I don't read most of them. I mean, it's you know, they're very long, they're, you know, hard to get through, and I kind of know what's in most of them, and the truth is, I don't know if this is how it should be, but I feel like I have kind of a fatalistic view about it, but that's because I think, you know, the way the law has allowed it to evolve.
Well, Ian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Ian McDougall is a contributing reporter for ProPublica, and his piece about online consumer contracts is called "Soon You May Not Even Have to Click on a Website Contract to Be Bound by Its Terms." Just ahead, today is National 529 College Savings Plan Day. We'll talk about those plans. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.